So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review.
Can you feel it, Bob? Can you feel it, everybody out there right now? If you don't feel it, then you ain't got no feeling at all. Here we are, the city, live noise at the UIC Pavilion. Got 10,000 fans out there screaming, sound like a million. And the reason why is Chi-Town Rumble, where a lot of careers might take a major stumble. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, I feel like Pete Rose out here in the lead match of an all-star game with this all-star card. You got four major titles that could change hands tonight. Do you realize that? Four titles. The number one contender title, the U.S. title. You got the World Television title, the World Tag Team title, and then the thing with the fever pitch, the biggie. Ric Flair and Rick Steamboat. But you know, I got my work cut out for me. This ain't no cakewalk whatsoever. So now, as you feel it, and as the lights go down, and you hear the music coming up, that means it's time for PS to do his stuff. So Bob, it's time when the music gets grinding. You know, so PS got to be right on time. So this is the way it is. Chi-Town Rumble 89. Ladies and gentlemen, it is showtime.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Review Away. It is John Pollock with Wei Ting. Hello, Wei.
Yeah.
Happy Chinese New Year.
Thanks.
Did you celebrate last night?
I did. Went out for dinner with my family and my relatives.
Did you get a red envelope?
Red pocket?
That's what I meant.
I remember. I believe so.
Yeah?
I think I did. Pretty sure I did.
Didn't spend it all in one place, did you?
I'm not married yet, so... That's custom.
Oh.
I received money.
Well, that's nice.
That means I'm never getting married.
So now that you're finally caught up, how are you liking 2015?
Great so far. Good so far.
Yeah. What year is this? What animal is represented in this year?
I believe it is a goat or like the sheep, like they say on WWE, JBL says. I get my Chinese
JBL
news from JBL.
Oh, so it's either going to be the year of Daniel Bryan or Eric Rowan.
Yeah. Yeah, sheep.
That's a
sheep
big difference.
Or ram. I don't know, whatever it is.
Oh, the ram.
Whatever. Aren't they the same thing? Similar? Whatever. Who cares?
How are you?
Awesome. Full of energy. Full of life.
Yeah.
Can't tell in my voice?
Yeah, I can tell. I'm making my way through Breaking Bad. I have 10 episodes to go.
Oh, wow. You really, like, you put a big dent into it.
Oh, yeah.
In the last season now.
Yeah, I'm almost done the first half of season 5.
Okay.
Just saw the train heist.
Great episode.
Oh, boy. The ending?
Yeah. I actually don't remember it much now, but...
Motorcycle, child. You don't recall this at all?
Actually, I forget.
Yeah. I got to be vague for folks out there.
Yeah, that's okay. Did you watch Better Call Saul?
You told me last week not to, so now I have 3 episodes saved on my DVR I'm done Breaking Bad.
You're better off.
Yes.
Trust me. I mean, honestly, I saw the first episode of Better Call Saul, and I think you can watch it without... You can still get it without watching Breaking Bad. But I feel like for a more complete experience, just wait.
Well, I'm going to finish Breaking Bad. I don't like to start multiple things... It just gets too confusing that way. Yeah. I can only handle one thing at a time, like one book, one TV series. That's it.
Yeah. Okay.
What are you watching right now? Is there anything?
I watched a show recently called Fresh Off the Boat.
How is this show? I have yet to see it.
It's supposedly a rather big deal for Asian Westerners, you know, especially like people like myself, you know, Asian people born here. To immigrant parents who really, I mean, historically, we've never really had any type of voice in pop culture. So this is sort of like a big show because it's the you know, one of the first shows with an all Asian cast, and it's written by this guy, or based on the life of this guy Eddie Huang, who released a book. A book called Fresh
Off
the Boat. Who released a book called Fresh Off the Boat. Basically, which are sort of like his memoirs of growing up as an Asian American kid, and I haven't read the book, but I've heard him on Rogan's podcast. I've heard him on DVD ASA, and I'm actually a big fan of his show on Vice, which creatively was also called Fresh Off the Boat.
Oh man, he's riding that wave.
Thing. Yeah. So, but he had his food show on Vice, Munchies. Which is still around now. It's called Huang's World, and that show is excellent. It's like his version of the Bourdain show, where he just goes to like various places to try different foods. But it's not just a food show. Like, he almost uses the food as an excuse to find more about the culture of the people there. And he won't just go to different restaurants. Like, I'm watching the Detroit episode where he goes to like this broken down warehouse where these homeless people live, and he tries to eat what they eat, and it's like, you know, like nasty hot pockets and stuff like that, and really it's just an excuse to, it's a vehicle, he uses food as a vehicle to kind of get to know more about the culture behind anybody. He'll go to Asia, China, whatever. So as a speaker, he's incredibly eloquent and incredibly entertaining. So watching
this show isn't kind of a stereotypical comedic look at Asians.
No, not at all. I mean, but this sitcom though, this one that everybody's talking about, that I believe is on ABC.
Sure,
one of the networks, whatever. It's more of a, it's a sitcom. Like, I think he had a hand in putting it together, but it's written by somebody else. It's played by other characters. Essentially, what it seems like to me is like it's an Asian version of Everybody Loves Chris. And, I mean, it stars the guy who played Kim Jong-il in The Interview.
The Interview.
Yeah, Randall Park. And he plays the dad. I mean, I watched the first two episodes, actually, and I think there are some funny aspects of it, but honestly, like, it's slightly better than your typical network sitcom, but I don't think I'll be really sticking around too much. I will say I think the kids are hilarious, but the adults just put on these like really forced accents that make it really uncomfortable to watch.
So it is a stereotypical comedy about Asians.
When it comes to the adults, the kids I really think are the funniest part.
More progressive representation.
The kids are like, I mean, like there's a guy who plays Eddie who, like, you know, is like big into rap culture, and he's just very funny, like a funny kid. But the dialogue just sounds so off and so, I don't know. It's hard to buy for the adults. That it's sort of a bit of a turnoff.
You think David Cho will guest star on this show? Maybe.
No, probably not. I don't think he's going to guest star in many things anymore.
How is
he's in a bit of a I don't know, controversy, I suppose.
Is he still involving that
the
deal of why he is
the masseuse story?
Yeah.
I think it's all still out there. So I mean. Whatever. I don't know. I don't even know what the fucking deal is, but I think it's like fucked up. So,
has he been still releasing shows?
Yeah, they're on another hiatus at the moment.
Oh god, him and his hiatuses.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you listen to it regularly still, or just kind of now and then? Oh, you still listen to it all
like
the time?
Every night, basically. Every Monday after we finish Review Raw, it'll be late, and I'll my brain will still be like kind of worked up before I can go to bed. So I'll just go home and like, you know, watch the podcast. They actually film it.
I downloaded. I want to try out that show Serial that everyone's been raving about.
This is like the biggest podcast in the world.
Yes,
Serial. I hear all about it too. How is it?
I haven't listened to it yet. I just downloaded the first episode yesterday. I'm gonna listen to it probably tonight at some point.
Did you ever listen to This American Life?
No, I didn't.
Your wife loves that show.
No,
right?
She listens to it all the time.
And does she listen to Serial?
She did. Yes.
Cool. What did she think?
Oh, she thought it was really good.
Cool.
That's about it. I have nothing to report on it yet.
I don't often hear about people talking about podcasts like in daily conversation like they have talked about Serial. I think I hear so many people talk about
podcasts. It's like it's released. It's almost like it's a you know, a serialized television show.
It's like Breaking Bad.
Yeah, where every week an episode comes out and then you talk about what happened on last night's show.
I don't know if there's ever a time in my life where I've heard people talk about any radio show through like it was some type of communal experience. You know, usually, hey, did you watch the Grammys? Did you watch, you know, the Blue Jays, whatever. Nobody ever says, did you listen to Ongoing History of New Music with Alan Cross last night? Wow.
It's still ongoing.
Yeah, it's so you too.
Which is weird because in my life, I consume way more like podcasts than I think I do. Well, throwing out what I have to watch for work,
yeah,
it's not even close.
The thing is, though, like podcasts are such a niche thing, you know, like chances are if you're listening to this show, your coworker likely has no idea, you know, what the hell we are.
There's a podcast out there for every person.
Yeah,
per person, and no one listens to the same podcast.
Your buddy will probably listen to a different podcast than you do. It's such a niche thing that we're not often able to like share our experiences with people we know in real life. But this thing Serial has gotten so big. I've heard multiple people talk about it. And I don't even watch it. I don't even listen to it.
Maybe there will be a wrestling version of Serial. Someone's going to put out a murder mystery over the course of 14 episodes.
I mean, I feel like we could that can be done in pro wrestling. I feel like it has been done, to be honest.
Let's start it next week. Start episode one next week.
Okay.
Of our own Serial. We'll go backwards, though. We'll go Memento style. We'll start with the the death.
Hey, what happened to that? This is completely unrelated.
Doesn't matter.
What happened to that Benoit biopic that was supposedly being...
It was in production for a while. To the best of my knowledge, it's still happening. But it was, gotta say, 18 months ago, 2 years ago, when they first announced that they had signed on someone to produce it.
Wasn't it, Liev Schreiber who was cast?
He was rumored, and then I think that wasn't true. I really don't know. I'm not up on the movie if it's still happening. My initial reaction kind of remains what I have today, that it's probably going to be some like really cheap, made-for-TV movie that's going to be pretty horrible.
Yeah.
That's my assumption. I will definitely watch it, but I think it'll be horrendously bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Okay.
We'll see. That's a future review as well.
I suppose. I mean, because we're journalists, we
have
to watch everything.
It.
I mean, yeah, if it's out there.
There's so much stuff out there now. So much stuff to keep track of.
Wrestling-wise.
Oh, yeah.
Like what?
In a typical week now, I watch Raw, SmackDown, NXT, Impact, ROH, Lucha Underground, the weekly six-hour UFC show, the monthly Bellator, sometimes two-a-month Bellator shows. That right there is like 8 or 9 things. New Japan has a weekly show every Friday. Okay. They have their specials every 3 weeks.
Is it worse now than it ever has been?
There's never been this much to watch at a given time. Even at the height of the Monday Night War, you didn't have this much product available to you. Certainly all of these promotions, or at least other promotions, existed beyond WWF, WCW, ECW, but you didn't have New Japan readily available to you on your television or have it available on the internet where you could go and just watch their weekly programming. It's just a lot, and I try to keep up on everything. It's very difficult. So much.
I think I've said it before, I think you're probably a lot more ambitious than even many journalists are to try to watch not just one sport, but all the content available to you from both sports. That's a lot to ask of yourself. So I feel like you could still do a great job even if you didn't watch every undercard fight. But I mean, at the same time, I know you're so dedicated that you feel like you need to watch everything.
Well, it's also different now because for pretty much every UFC show, we're now broadcasting them. So it's not even an option to skip it.
Yeah.
So I like watching UFCs. They're the longest ones, and they typically are the ones that drag the least for me. I find that they do flow pretty well.
I feel the reason why is simply because every fight on a UFC card not necessarily matters in the grand scheme of things. It's not like every match has an effect on the title, on championships. But every match is of incredible significance for the people involved in that match. You know what I mean?
Yep.
No matter what placement on the card you're in, you know, every fight, like even on a prelim fight, somebody's very first UFC fight is an incredibly big deal for that person, having worked, you know, however hard they have to get to that spot. And you can't say this really the same about, you know, your typical Raw undercard or typical pro wrestling undercard, where honestly, I mean, the outcome is largely meaningless.
Well, I think it's also structured in such a way where any given Bellator fight, any fight you watch, it has the potential to be the best fight of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in WWE, you will know based on the performers involved, okay, they're getting 6 minutes on SmackDown. Yeah. This is not going to be the match of the year.
The time constraints, the booking.
And there's a large percentage of matches, and you brought this up on Review of Raw, which is a great point, the fact that 10 minutes after that match, you may never think of that match ever again.
Mm-hmm.
There's no consequence to have to see the latest match with Seth Rollins and Dolph Ziggler. That's a great match every time out. Monday's match on Raw, no significance. That will never be referenced again. You can just discard it. Fun 5-minute match, DQ finish, you'll never think of it again. It's mm-hmm. just, they can have great matches, but are they important matches? And that's just the reality of you're producing all this television, and that's just the structure of things when you have the same guys that you have to use to fill all of these hours of television.
Yeah, there are no stakes for each match, but
it's not like Michael Hayes going after Russian Assassin number one, where that crowd, they lived and died for Michael Hayes.
What do you think is the difference between then and now? I mean, that match was that match honestly
no
that important?
Important. I will say this, watching this Chi-Town Rumble, there was certainly this audience. It felt like the performers were so much more over from top to bottom,
mm-hmm.
and it built towards the main event. I think that they were just such a rabid audience that were just invested in these characters, were winning and losing. They viewed these matches as having some form of stakes from the mm-hmm. television they watched, and certainly we're just picking one isolated show. We don't know all the context of all the television leading up to this, where the momentum was for different performers, but this crowd was into every single match on this show, yeah. regardless of whether you considered it a good match, bad match. This crowd, they love these baby faces and they hated the heels throughout this.
It's all often the case, though, with a lot of these 80 shows. You know, the crowds are always very hot, maybe full of younger audiences that probably are able to suspend their disbeliefs a bit more. And I would also assume that seeing these matchups were probably a much rarer occurrence than what we get today.
You know? You didn't get giant shows every single, not every month at least, to the degree that we get pay-per-views now and you get name versus name throughout a 3-hour broadcast every single Monday night. So these were very special when you would have a pay-per-view or you built to a Clash of the Champions card. And we go back to Monday night, February the 20th of 1989. Almost the anniversary.
Completely unintentional.
Yeah, we picked this because Wei wanted to go back and review Flair and Steamboat.
I saw it on the network. The
network sold you on the Chi-Town Rumble.
Totally.
They were airing the Clash of Champions that aired the Wednesday prior to this event, which they showed highlights of.
Where Ricky Steamboat proceeded to strip Ric Flair, tear apart his suit, and we got to see Ric Flair with half a pant leg chopping Ricky Steamboat.
Which was later, Ric Flair has done that angle numerous times in his career, but also they did with Scott Steiner and Triple H once to recreate, stripping Triple H to his underwear. The old stripping a man of his suit. Big consequences in 1989 when suits were a big deal.
Still a big deal.
I guess so. If someone tore my suit, I'd be livid.
Yeah. Imagine that happened at like an award show, a red carpet.
Oh, imagine if Kanye had done that to Beck.
Oh, wow.
Did you watch? I know we talked about it.
I saw Kanye on SNL. That's what you're going to ask her.
I was damn impressed.
Really?
Singing off your back like that?
What's the big deal?
Dude, try doing that.
I did the song verbatim right afterwards on my floor, and it was I was pretty damn good, but it's hard.
What's so Dude, hard?
You know what?
Try it right now. I don't even know the song.
I think you're the one that's doubting this is easy. If you were to lie on your back and do this podcast,
okay,
on your back,
sure.
Dude, this would be really, really damn hard. I don't know if the mic will stretch this far. Oh yeah, we're playing with fire here.
I could totally do the show off of my back, like on my back. It'd be the easiest show ever. I mean, it'd be relaxing.
Hold on,
is what it is. We're gonna try this.
I just want you to like talk for a minute off your back.
Why wouldn't I be able to do that?
Dude, I'm just saying, it's gonna be harder than you think. I was really impressed with Kanye. I forgave him for the Grammys, just with this performance alone.
Holy fuck.
All these chords, man, I swear to God.
You'd think like a bomb would go off in this thing.
Okay. So you're gonna lie down. We really need to be doing video more often. Oh. You might have to substitute the headphones.
Okay. I'm on my back.
No. Head down.
Head down?
Maybe turn your rotate yourself around.
How about now?
Oh, that could work.
I'm on my back. This is incredible. It's so comfortable. Why wouldn't I be able to do the show like this?
Now imagine singing a song from this.
Yeah.
With a crowd in front of you.
They wouldn't be in front of me. They'd be like...
Just tell me about why you wanted to watch the Chi-Town Rumble. Explain to me.
Well, it looked... Really...
Also, pretend you're holding a microphone.
Okay.
Let's get the full Kanye experience here.
I mean, the show... Oops. Am I still plugged in?
Yeah. Oh.
It's okay.
Your headphones on.
It's fine. It's fine.
But
I wanted to record the Chi-Town Rumble to review it because it's it looked like a lot of fun. It's a show that a lot of people have talked about, this classic Flair Steamboat feud. And I mean, I feel like as somebody who watches so much wrestling every single week, I'm a little, you know, I felt like it was something that I needed to have to watch to complete my own, you know, knowledge of the history of this fine sport.
All right, you're proving my theory wrong here. You sound
Why the fuck wouldn't I be able to do this? Like, this is like the best way to do a podcast.
So you weren't impressed at all that this guy?
I thought it was
started doing
was,
Jesus walks off his back.
I thought it was so lame. I thought it was like, oh my god, this guy is just like, he thinks he's such an artist. You know, I'm gonna do this so differently. I'm gonna do a song on my back. Like it's like he really wishes he went to art school, you know what I mean? And if he did go to art school, he'd realize how corny he came across on TV.
Wow, man, no love for Kanye at all. I feel the guy gets too much.
He's so annoying now. He's really obnoxious, and I think if his aim is to play heel, to troll, then he does a great job of it. But I don't necessarily think. Don't you love like when they cut away to him during the top 10?
Yes.
He just didn't seem to like it. He didn't seem to want to be there.
I was wishing there would have been a Beck cameo. That would have been great.
That would have been awesome. Can I finish the show?
Just you can do whatever you want. It's up to you.
This is very comfortable.
Oh, man. Well, okay.
You've never, like, talked on the phone in bed?
Yeah, listen, I think it's very different than performing a song off your back. Listen, I just thought it was an awkward angle to be doing that on live television, no less.
Okay.
And he did it seamlessly.
Yeah, well,
I don't think I could do it.
He is talented, but I wouldn't really consider singing off your back that great of a talent. Okay, I'm gonna get up.
Well, you mastered the art of the podcast off your back. Very impressed by Wei Ting, a man of many talents, and showcasing us his latest one.
What can I say?
How long did it take you to watch this particular event?
took me, I started half of it last week and then probably finished maybe like three quarters. I started maybe a quarter last week, finished three quarters this week.
I waiting this one and I kind of left it to the last minute. So we recorded Raw on Monday night and then I came home to watch this Flair Steamboat. I left Flair Steamboat till the end. I knew that would be the easiest match to watch of the entire card. And then I'm watching it 2:30 in the morning and then I had missed it all show long. And then I spot in that green shirt in the front row, Dave Meltzer was at this event.
I didn't know this until you pointed it out to me. I mean, but once you see him, it's hard to not pay attention anymore. It's like he's like dead center in the front row.
He had connections.
Camera side.
Yeah, and I'm sure all the talent, or at least most of them, were aware of, hey, that's Dave Meltzer in the front row.
Really?
I'm sure a good...
Yeah.
How do you think Dave got his tickets, first of all?
Yeah, that's true. But if I was Dave, I wouldn't want to be that close up on TV. Like, it's actually a lot of pressure being on TV that close. Like, you're always on camera, and you have to feel like you need to react the way you're supposed to because you're being watched.
Oh, I would be a rock if I was... I don't react to things when I'm live at events. I just have no ability to... move.
Well, most of the time you're taking notes. So
that's true. That's true. Dave was not taking any notes.
No, he's there as a fan.
And if you had any doubt that he was not giving this main event 5 stars, which he did, it was displayed in incredible visual form during this match. Well, he loved this match.
He seemed to love this match. But,
and I wouldn't have blamed him. Like this. Yeah. Imagine being there live for this match in 1980. I was in awe watching this in 2015.
He picked a great match, a great show to attend live.
Oh, I'm sure he had high expectations going in. Can you imagine being live at this match? And I have watched this match before, but I haven't watched it in years. And I was loving watching this. Could you imagine watching this live? And then Dave goes home, and I'm sure he rewatched this immediately,
mm-hmm.
and then got Jim Ross's commentary, which he may have been the best performer of all three.
Yeah.
His call, we talked last week about Mauro Ranallo and Josh Barnett and one of the best calls of a match. My God, if this wasn't as good, if not better.
Yeah.
This was an unbelievable call by Jim Ross of that main event. This might be my favorite match I've ever heard Jim Ross call.
Yeah, I mean, growing up with Jim Ross's commentary in the WWE, we know how he sounds like, we know his style, but I think...
Very different from when he was calling the NWA. This was such a different style than what he did in the WWE.
I really feel like this was... It almost seemed like he was at his peak here, you know? Like, I feel like I've talked a lot about commentary over the past couple of weeks, but I feel like almost everything I said about the show, the New Japan show last week, I could really apply to Jim Ross here. Just the way he was able to, just his smooth professional broadcasting flow, and also the way he was able to follow action to accentuate the energy of a match, and the level of like seriousness he was able to talk about these matches. He just made everything seem like a real sporting event.
He called it like a big world title match, and it was different than how he called any of the other matches on the undercard. It was like a switch went off where he escalated into the main event and like breaking down Ric Flair, a product of the private school sector, and Ricky Steamboat represented public schools.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, I just love this call. Like, everything about this was fucking great, this main event.
Yeah. And I think, you know, like, when I think about Jim Ross now, I think about maybe, like, 2000s WWF or even, like, Attitude Era WWF, which he was great at, too. He was incredible there, too. But obviously, that type of style, you know, called on a bit more flash, a bit more, like... He's selling Undertaker angles and things like that, you know?
Which is pretty incredible, where I don't think people appreciate how much he altered his style in the WWE throughout his tenure there, and both were excellent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you're asking me, like, he could reach such a high emotion on either of them, but they were totally different calls. And to imagine the fact that you watch this, and their direction to this guy who called this match was... Well, we don't want you necessarily calling the moves. We want you telling the story, but not so much
utilizing the holds and the maneuvers. We want to get away from that. I mean, that's kind of what he was under towards the end of his run at the WWE and what he was facing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want this kind of 1989 style of call, which that's your prerogative. Yeah. But it's amazing that that would be the conclusion that you come with if you were to listen to this guy in the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, he was great here.
So Jim Ross and Magnum TA were the ones calling the show. And they kicked it off by previewing all of the matches, the title matches that we had.
You know, this show, immediately I noticed it featured a lot of names that are still very, very relevant today.
Yeah.
Today's scene. I mean, you had Sting on this card. You had Paul Heyman featured role on this card. And even just people that we hear about often these days, like a Jim Cornette or, you know, even like a Mike Rotundo.
Yeah. And at this time in early 1989, just to set the scene, certainly kind of the peak of Jim Crockett Promotions had passed, but 1989 in the ring was one of, if not their strongest year, mainly through Ric Flair, Ricky Steamboat, Terry Funk. They had some tremendous talent at this point, but Dusty Rhodes had been let go as booker at the end of 1988 and was in the midst of being in Florida before he would go to the WWF in the polka dot era. So George Scott had been installed as the booker, and he was not going to last long. He would be gone just a few months after this. But at this particular time, George Scott, who was also one of the bookers during the WWF's national expansion a couple of years earlier, so he had been a key power figure, had been installed as the booker at this time. So you're kind of coming off the real big peak of Jim Crockett Promotions, but certainly the talent at this time, incredible when you look at it, like top to bottom, some of the performers they had throughout here.
Oh, yeah, some all-time, you know, names, big names here.
They had Bob Caudle in the back throughout this show, just doing interviews, and they cut a lot of these out of the WWE Network version because I
was going to ask you about that because it certainly seemed like they really tried to cut the length of time in between the end of a match to the backstage.
It was abrupt because really abrupt. I did have the VHS of the Chi-Town Rumble, which I watched part of it on, and they cut out a solid like 15 minutes of entrances, mm-hmm. interviews in the back. So you got these really it was almost like watching TNA,
yeah.
where a match ends, boom, we go to the back, and you had no time, like the big title celebration for Lex Luger, boom, you cut away.
Or a big turn happens.
But all on the original version, like Luger's in the ring, he's celebrating with the title.
Yeah,
I can understand some entrances that maybe for copyright reasons you would cut, but a post-match celebration, you're not under any time constraints on the network. I don't know why some of this stuff was cut down so significantly.
I could only assume that the actual tapes that they received from WCW were probably already cut like this. But, I mean, this show clocked in at about 2:30, 2 hours 30 minutes.
Which was always something the NWA did with their home video releases, was they would take a 3-hour pay-per-view and release it as a 2-hour take, okay. like to save basically yeah. and record on a lower quality.
Or so higher quality.
Or SP, I guess it would be the higher quality. So you get 2 hours, but they just randomly cut out 45 minutes of the pay-per-view.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's just a constraint of the medium. But how long were these shows originally when they were broadcast?
This was a full 3-hour pay-per-view.
So they basically chopped out half an hour somewhere.
Well, it was the version I had was like 2 hours, 45 minutes, which is the standard okay. length of a 3-hour pay-per-view. So they cut out 15 minutes of content, but no matches cut out. So Bob Caudle's first of hundreds of interviews was with Michael Hayes, who is about to face the Russian Assassin, number one. Did you notice this, where he said the word Chicago and they censored it?
I don't know about that.
It was silenced.
I know. I think it might have been just the dropout on his butt.
It had to have been.
Yeah. Why would they censor the name of the city?
If this was Vince McMahon, I would totally see town.
We can only call it Chi-Town. We cannot call it Chicago. The name of the show is the Chi. By the way, if you can see the graphic for this very show, I mean, I really love the box art for this.
Oh, it's cool.
Yeah, that old painted, you know, poster.
How about the Giorgio Moroder style theme Moroder. Music to come in?
Moroder?
Is that how you say his
Moroder.
Name?
Moroder. Moroder.
Scarface. Midnight Express.
Yeah.
I love this. Like, it's such a
oh, yeah.
cheesy 80s kind of yeah. music to come into with.
Yeah, on the network, though, they did cut out the Midnight Express theme, unfortunately.
Yeah. But they did have Michael Hayes, Bad Street USA.
I believe they own that.
they had a big dispute with the guy who was the creator of that song, but they, I believe they have since settled that suit. Okay. So anyway, he just, Michael Hayes is in the back, just your prototypical 80s babyface, rah-rah promo. Says he feels like Pete Rose leading an all-star team by being in the first match tonight.
I don't know if I call him... I mean, I wasn't really watching wrestling at the time, but this guy didn't really seem typical. Like, honestly, when you see him, he just immediately stands out to me amongst everybody else with the way he speaks and just his undeniable charisma. I feel like often the guy probably gets a really terrible rep right now for whatever he is, but you watch him perform, speak in front of a mic, and you have to respect that aspect of his...
Well, I think as well, in this era... You know, a promo like Michael Hayes, that was just, like, that was nothing crazy out of the realm. I mean, there were promos at that time where I think there are much less of them today, where a promo like this stands out in 2015, and this was just opening match guy who was a great, and that was Michael Hayes' strength. It was his promos more than anything. And they go through all the matches, and comes... Russian Assassin number one with his manager, Paul Jones.
What's the deal with these Russian assassins? What is that?
Just a mask gimmick. This was David Sheldon under a mask.
We need a Russian
villain. And numerous ones.
Yeah. Okay.
Without any name. No Vladimirs, no Boris, no Russian Assassin number one.
Random Russian guy number one.
David Sheldon was a big bodybuilder type and died about 8 years ago. But here he was in the brief time in Jim Crockett Promotions taking on Michael Hayes. Magnum brings up the unpredictiality of Paul Jones at ringside.
Okay.
Unpredictiality.
Could be a word.
Why not? They battled for a headlock, and it was just amazing the heat that they got for just the simplest of things here. And this was my big takeaway watching some of these undercard matches. Ross explains that Michael Hayes has two sides to him. Sometimes he's a nice guy to speak with, and sometimes he has a Charles Manson-like stare. There were some great descriptions throughout this show to get across different personalities.
Hayes, what did you think of Magnum TA?
You know what? I thought he was fine. This was certainly after his car wreck that ended his career. He was pegged to be their top babyface star, and they segued him into this color commentator role. He did a great job of laying out when Jim Ross was ready to go. Mm-hmm. Not all unlike Josh Barnett.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. And sometimes that can be the mark of a great color commentator where he knows when to lay out. Mm-hmm. He never tried to overpower Jim Ross. He was just a quiet, calming, nuts and bolts guy.
Didn't also try to, over-exaggerate the energy in his voice. Which
I think natural.
I think many commentators are prone to do. No. John just pointed to himself, and that's not necessarily true. I
like Magnum TA on this show. The commentary was, as I've said, watching these two together, and then you watch some of the stuff today, and it's just... Mm-hmm. I don't mean to shit on everybody today, but this was just a great team.
He did do a good job, yeah.
Ross notes how Hayes started wrestling at the age of 17. He is now 27. This man who... I have never looked at Michael Hayes and thought less than 35.
Wait, what did... Because I remember looking that up. How old did they say he was?
They said he was 27 at this time in 1989, which I believe is right. Gave a background of the Freebirds starting off in 1979. Russian Assassin goes to hit the Russian Sickle, which basically looked like a bad flying clothesline, and then is choking Hayes illegally as Ross breaks down the fundamentals of how this choke can take away the oxygen. He was great at just breaking down what are these holds doing, and why should you care about a rear chin lock, for instance.
And again, this is like an aspect of Jim Ross's commentary that I don't think I even remember hearing about, hearing him try to execute in his WWE runs, especially later on.
And, this is something where if you're listening to these kinds of breakdowns on your commentary every single week and a guy goes for a basic hold, you get more of a reaction to it because it's being explained to you what this does. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you were doing a jiu-jitsu match and a guy got a rear chin lock on you and was transitioning to a rear naked choke?
High drama.
That's the end of the match.
Oh, yeah.
That's tons of drama. And in wrestling, it's a sit-on-your-hand spot.
Yeah.
There's no urgency.
It's a time for the announcers to talk about what they think of the Oscars.
Those guys aren't brothers, though.
Ross says that the fans are going to be making this noise, and it's going to get all the way back to the Kremlin. And there's a bulldog from Hayes to the assassin. And Ross also notes that very methodical are these athletes from the Soviet Union. They rarely make mistakes. But the assassin runs shoulder first into the post for a big pop. Hayes hits him with his, quote, all-American right hands in the corner. Assassin sets up for a back body drop, but this allows Hayes to hit his finish. The DDT for the win, 15 minutes and 48 seconds. And making my job even easier, Gary Michael Capetta announcing the time of the fall, 15 minutes, 48 seconds. And huge reaction for Michael Hayes getting the win. And, you know, you watch this on mute, not much of a match at all. But the crowd was into it. Commentary got you into things. And it really, to me, emphasized how you can add a lot of sizzle to a very basic match that was really nothing special on its own.
I agree. I mean, just watching the wrestling itself, the style is very dated and slow. And you could even say sloppy by today's standards. But the standout you take away is that there really is no doubting how over Michael Hayes was and how easy this crowd was able to hate this random Russian man underneath a mask. Oh, he's Russian? Fuck him. Don't like him.
Those Russians.
Yeah.
Bob Caudle is with Ricky Steamboat in the back with his wife Bonnie and son, Ricky Steamboat Jr., who was in WWE developmental for a while and then had this back injury that might just end his career. And remember...
He hasn't been back in a long time.
He hasn't been wrestling for at least 2.5 years, I would say, at this point. And this, of course, a very very familiar with these two because it was the prior year at WrestleMania, the tournament where Ricky came out with his son famously in the ring and his wife Bonnie, and it was shortly after that that he left the WWF and would return to the NWA.
And why did he leave?
There was a big dispute between himself and the company where in 87, they'd done the big build-up for the Savage title switch. Ricky Steamboat won the title, and his wife was pregnant, and he wanted some time off for his son to be born. And they were upset because they were like, we put all this effort and time into you winning the IC title. And at that time, that championship headlined one of the house show tours. They were running multiple cities every night. So the IC champion was a huge deal. They needed him. And he ended up taking that time off. They took the title off him after just a couple of months. And it would end up where he would come back in 88 for that tournament. And they just they eliminated him in the first round. And it was just kind of not a good relationship afterwards, and he decided he was going to leave. So, and then he would go back a few years later, and he would be rechristened the Dragon and be a lifelike dragon. So don't get into disputes. So anyway, he talks about getting his strength from the family unit, which was kind of how they pushed Flair and Steamboat. Here was the womanizer against the family man. Mm. And, you know, sadly, Ricky Steamboat would get divorced from his wife, Bonnie, and she would, for a brief time, own his name.
Oh, right.
Ricky Steamboat.
So that means he should have went with Flair. Should have went with money instead of family.
I guess this was the big philosophical dilemma in the main event.
Always go with money.
He, the kid, the little, like, two-year-old child tries to grab the mic from Bob Caudle, and Caudle's, like, pulling it away.
He was adorable.
And then Steamboat says, this is always fun to go back and watch promos before bigger events happen, says, I'm not O.J. Simpson going after Jim Brown. And he's winning this match for those out there that work 8-to-5.
Oh, okay.
Not those 9-to-5ers, not those lazy fucks. The ones who get to work an hour earlier.
Yeah.
Ricky Steamboat working for the... For the people. I guess filling that void since Dusty left for the common man.
Mm-hmm. I thought he was really he really is a great baby face, I think.
Oh, a true one of the best.
Just somebody who's immediately likable, just even by looking at him. And the visual of him standing there with his family, it really is such a, I don't know, almost so cliche now. But I think considering, you know, now if he were to do this, he'd be just booed out of the building, I think. It's so cheesy, But I think back then it worked really well, especially put up against Flair.
And Ricky Steamboat is one I always look at. When today, Ricky Steamboat would be murdered by people online for being such a bad promo. He's not charismatic enough. And I've always thought, no, this promo worked perfectly for this time, for this babyface, who is just a straightforward, stand-up guy, that it worked. I don't need a whole roster of Michael Hayes promos if you're a babyface. I like having a Ricky Steamboat or a Bret Hart where, yeah, by our definition of charisma, it's not the same charisma, but this guy was charismatic.
Yeah, he's not The Rock, he's not Steve Austin, but
He was beloved by these people.
He's a great wrestler. You know, he's the guy who goes out there and can actually, you know, just do it without talking about it.
Next matchup was Sting against Hacksaw Butch Reed. This being almost a year removed from the 45-minute time limit draw with Ric Flair that Sting had. Not 60 minutes. So Sting, that was a big turning point for him, and it was evident here, as they outlined in the commentary, that Sting may in fact be the wrestler of the 90s coming up. So big things planned for Sting at this point, that they had kind of christened him as the next big babyface project. Referee was Teddy Scullett Long.
Oh, God.
That hair.
Just.
Never has a man gone bald and it been more worthwhile.
Oh, man. It's gross. Disgusting, oily, long Scullett.
Okay. Teddy Long went through some phases. Like, he had the Scullett look. Then he would manage Doom and, would give a run for any Scott Putski candidate. I mean, he jacked up.
Wow.
And you don't think of Teddy Long as a jacked up dude, but you go back to some of those 1990 tapes when he was with Doom, and guy was lifting. So they give some background on Sting, this youngster from Southern California. Ross says he was discovered by Red Bastien at Gold's Gym and added a leaping ability to his arsenal that we're going to see here. He's learned how to jump. He's like Larry Bird or Magic Johnson.
It sounds so ridiculous. At one point, JR even compares him to, like, NBA players, his ability to jump. It sounds so silly, but I think Ross, in his voice, does such a great job selling it. It really makes you think the guy is some kind of innovator, a man who has invented jumping in professional wrestling.
Ross notes, and there were some subtle references throughout this show, "This is the NWA, and we wrestle here."
Ooh.
You fucking clowns. Sting wrenches this headlock, and Magnum TA breaks down how debilitating a tight headlock can be and what damage it's doing to Butch Reed. Reed runs his elbow into the corner, missing Sting, and Sting applies his loose Kimura with an added touch by biting the hand behind the referee's back. I am going to try this.
Okay.
Let's see how it works.
Try it in competition.
Yes. Reed then sends Sting through the ropes to the floor and gets the advantage, dropping, quote, soup bones. And then Magnum pipes in because we had Hiro Matsuda in Butch Reed's corner. Hiro Matsuda, listen, a legendary figure amongst a lot of guys that trained under this man. The most useless manager.
He was all over the show.
He was in everyone's corner, from Flair to Wyndham. He was, of course, attached with the Horsemen at this point. But Butch Reed as well served zero purpose. Like, he just stood there. Didn't do anything, didn't get involved. He didn't speak. Like, he was useless.
Was it just not so, you know, he just was, it was a common association, a common link between all the heels? Was that not really?
That was kind of his role, but it was, you know, he didn't accentuate anybody.
No, it didn't really build heat, you know, amongst the audience. He just kind of stood there, yeah.
But as Magnum TA notes, Orientals, and as soon as that word comes out of an 80s broadcast, my ears pipe up. Because whatever follows it, it doesn't matter.
Jim, I can't see from this viewpoint, but, you know, those Orientals know all those pressure points and all those holes as well. And this could have ended the match right here. The Stinger is in a lot of trouble, and it's not even his fault. From our vantage point, couldn't really tell exactly what Matsuda was doing. You know, the Orientals have a lot of different ways of working on you without it looking too bad. And Butch Reed's definitely going to capitalize on this situation.
Orientals have a lot of different ways of working on you without it looking too bad.
Right.
Is that true?
Well, you better watch out. We have a lot of ways.
without making it look bad.
Yeah, you just think, ah, oh, he's got nothing here, and then all of a sudden you're tapping out.
Yeah. Do you also notice, like, now when you're watching the network, they put in little boards at the front saying some of the language expressed or some of the views expressed on these broadcasts do not reflect those of WWE?
I've seen the warnings, too, where they have, like, these characters are not based on real people.
Yeah, I've seen that one. But I think recently
That's there for Benoit.
I've seen the one where they say, you know, some of the language expressed aren't reflective of such and such.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's through things like this.
Well, there's one segment of history, and that being pro wrestling history. I'm sure there is a lot of commentary on some of these shows that doesn't necessarily reflect your most PC of viewpoints.
Yeah, but I mean, I didn't really... First of all, this was a heel Asian gimmick. So, I mean, and secondly, I imagine something that I think is viewed as taboo now probably wasn't as taboo back then. So, I mean, I don't
wait till you get some of those mid 80s Greg Valentine, Roddy Piper promos when they were facing black wrestlers.
Mm, cool. I look forward to that.
I don't know if those ones will make the cut onto the network, but they might. Reed misses a flying clothesline, heads off to the floor, and I don't know what happened here because he went for this flying clothesline and then he missed it, and then he rolls to the floor and JR just tries to cover it, saying that his momentum has taken him out of the ring. So there was a spinning neck breaker for a two count on Sting, a jawbreaker. Crowd just explodes for Sting's comeback. Reed lands on top, grabs the rope, and then Long kicks the arm of Reed off the rope, and Sting rolls him up. 20 minutes and 7 seconds this thing went.
Uh-huh.
And then Reed tries to attack Sting after the match, but Sting thwarts him. Butch Reed should never be in a 20-minute match. And at this point in his career, Sting probably shouldn't either. But again, this crowd, they loved Sting.
I was really surprised at the style of match that these guys wrestled, you know, especially because I was expecting more of a brawl, but they actually worked a rather, I don't know, intricate match, I would say. And what I mean by that is, like, they're these really long chin locks. I mean, they're, like, really long. But I thought Butch Reed was able to make it look somewhat dramatic by doing various things like pulling tights and just various heel tactics to make it a bit more drawn out. And the finish, too, was just sort of like a reversal from a pin sequence that just kind of came out of nowhere, which I didn't really expect from these two. So a little long to watch, a little tough to watch, especially with eyes from, you know, 2015. But I can't say it was a bad match either.
Bob Caudle is with Paulie dangerously in his pink and white shirt, with Randy Rose and late replacement Jack Victory. They'd been doing this feud between the original Midnight Express of Randy Rose and Dennis Condrey that Paulie Dangerously had brought into the territory to feud with Jim Cornette's updated version of the Midnight Express, Stan Lane and Bobby Eaton. And this was all building to this match. It was going to be a six-man tag with Dangerously and Cornette part of the match, and the loser of the fall would leave the NWA. But Dennis Condrey, who was not happy with the booking at this particular time, basically told them, fuck you, I'm not showing up at this show. So at the last minute, they inserted Jack Victory into this match, and Dennis Condrey would, I guess, take the figurative fall and leave the NWA.
How awkward.
But before doing the match, where he just wasn't going to give them the pleasure of booking him out of the territory. So,
okay, so the person, I mean, we're going to get to the end of the match maybe prematurely, but the person who actually lost the match, did that person actually get kicked out?
Yeah, they
so two people left as a result of this.
The original Midnights were done.
Oh my. Okay. What a weird thing.
Paulie Dangerously cut a promo about how there's a disease called Cornettitis that they're going to cure.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well,
lively promo.
What do you think of Paul Heyman back then versus Paul Heyman now in terms of his promo ability and promo style?
I always have enjoyed Paulie Dangerously's promos. I mean, he's always been a very good promo. But you watch this, and it's really put into focus how different this guy has evolved into his many different characters over the years.
And in what way do you think? Do you think he's
because my thinking is, I thought he's always his tone and his delivery has always been excellent, and I feel like there are a lot of guys, probably anywhere, who wishes that they could talk even like Paul Heyman in the 1980s, much less Paul Heyman today. So I'm thinking, if you're Paul Heyman in the 1980s, like, what are you thinking to get to the next level? What do you think you need to improve to get to that next level?
Well, I've always kind of associated the different variations of Paul Heyman as like a character that was on a different drug. Like the 80s, mm-hmm. like this guy was on crank. Then he'd go into like ECW where it felt like this dude might be on meth. And then we would graduate to the current Paul Heyman where it seems like this is a guy that's much more thoughtful. Maybe smokes a lot of weed, but he's really intelligent. Like that intelligent
right.
okay. marijuana smoker.
Okay, so maybe more refined, more yes. controlled, not as wild.
As we've seen. Yeah, he has the experience of all that. He has
right. not as like out there, not as like maybe imaginative and
like unwieldy. This Paulie dangerously yeah. looked like he was about to have a heart attack on camera typically. Whereas mm-hmm. that is not what you see from Paul Heyman today. He's a much more calculated, cerebral promo.
Interesting. That's very interesting.
Yes. Kind of like you.
What?
Like you're much more refined. Like you're on something. I don't know what it is.
Green
tea. It's a very, very calming method.
Green tea.
Oh, green something.
Matcha.
So we had Randy Rose, Jack Victory, and Paulie Dangerously against Stan Lane, Bobby Eaton, and Jim Cornette. And Cornette is wearing this crazy red spandex outfit.
Mm-hmm.
He was dressed for a match.
Paul Heyman was wearing like a pink
this like
sweatshirt.
God, something like you'd wear in Miami in 1989.
Something you'd wear to get people to boo you, basically.
Or a man that's on crank.
That too?
Possibly. Lane catches Rose and tosses him off the top, clotheslines him over the top. Ross says that Heyman is in white and pink. Looks like he's either coming from or going to a baby shower. Another comparison. There's a huge pop as Cornette comes in and hits an elbow drop to Jack Victory, then takes Randy Rose to the heel corner and dangerously slaps Rose by mistake without looking in the direction of where he was throwing the slap. And then Eaton is tossed into the barricade. They tease a confrontation with Cornette and dangerously that the crowd is really hot. That's the showdown they want to see. Rose then slams Cornette. Paul comes in, stomping him down, rakes him in the eyes and attacks Cornette and then quickly tags out. Lane ends up coming in. He's beaten down for a while. He blocks a pile driver, and then the original Midnights continue with the heat on Lane, finally makes the hot tag to Bobby Eaton, who hits a missile drop kick off the top to Victory, grabs Dangerously, pulls him in, then tags in Cornette, who slaps Dangerously around. All six are in the ring. Randy Rose misses a splash off the top. There's a near fall as Jack Victory makes the save, and then the finish comes when there's a double flapjack delivered to Randy Rose, and Stan Lane pins him at 15:54, and Randy Rose is ejected from the NWA, courtesy of the new Midnight Express.
Mm, done. I thought the build-up to Dangerously versus Cornette worked really well. The reaction they get when they finally get in together was huge. And, you know, I think we often look at matches involving non-wrestlers as sort of like throwaway comedy matches, but I thought here, even though both men are clearly not wrestlers at all, I think they're so great at all other aspects of wrestling, that being the charisma and making the crowd, getting a reaction from the crowd just by their actions, that I think in combination with four other men who can wrestle, it works really well.
Randy Rose would leave the NWA for a time, and Paulie Dangerously would go on to bring in the Samoan SWAT team as his new team. Rose would return to the NWA for a brief time in mid-1989. And then in 1990 and 91, Rose wrestled for Georgia All-Star Wrestling and Global Wrestling Federation, and today he's very involved with charity work. So that's the cool update on Randy Rose.
Well, it sounds like he made a good choice leaving. It was like a blessing in disguise. Does charity work now?
Bob Caudle is with Ric Flair, and can't have a Ric Flair promo without Hiro Matsuda to just fill in the blanks if Ric Flair forgets anything during his promo. I mean, Rick was still trying to find his voice at this time, of course. Guarantees a win, and that Chicago will be on fire. Which, I don't know if Would that be a little too close to home if you were a...
When was the Chicago Fire?
I mean, decades before. Was it okay to...
Yeah, come on.
Yeah, it's okay at this point. Matsuda just pointless here was my notes.
I mean, this was just... Anytime you get a Ric Flair promo from this era, I feel like some rapper out there is going to sample it, and we'll probably hear like a quote from this in some song.
That needs to be the focus of Ric Flair's podcast, like having rappers on the podcast every week.
It really is amazing that he's become such a hit with rap culture as of late. Because
all of them grew up watching this guy.
Not necessarily. I mean, maybe, yeah, perhaps. But
or
I think
influenced by.
But I just think the character of Ric Flair in this state, like, it perfectly exemplifies sort of the extravagance and the materialism and just the success of, you know, of many of what rappers, you know, hope to show with their images. It really is perfect.
I was so glad that I did reference my VHS of this particular event, because after this Flair promo, we just cut to Rick Steiner and Mike Rotunda skipping past a hell of a promo as Bob Caudle interviewed Rick and Scott Steiner in the back.
No, I missed this.
Yes. If you recall, don't think that bad storylines are just simply exclusive to modern wrestling, because we go back to 1989 when Rick Steiner, a fantastic collegiate wrestler who had come in as a wrestler's wrestler in the NWA, but unfortunately had an invisible friend named Alex. And Bob Caudle asked Rick about Alex, and they brought in Scott to explain that...
You know, this is my brother Scott.
Scott, hey, what is this with Alex and with Rick?
Well, I'll tell you, Bob, at one time my brother wasn't normal. We both attended University of Michigan together, both wrestled there, both were All-Americans there. And it all changed the day he got in an accident.
You mean... Is that what happened to him, Scott?
Yeah, well, the doctor said, and the specialist said he can't function in society by himself. So I guess that's where Alex comes in. So when I'm not there, I guess he talks to Alex.
Well, I'm all right. Alex just helps run a ring. I just forget sometimes when Alex is, you know.
When you forget, Alex reminds
you. Yeah,
he talks
to me and stuff, you know, and helps me out in the ring. But just sometimes I forget, you know. You forget.
Yeah, I forget too, but I don't talk to Alex, Rick. I don't have an Alex to talk to.
A while back, Rick got into an accident, and because of this accident, he cannot function in society alone. That's where Scott comes in. But Scott can't be around him all the time, so that's where Alex comes in. When Scott is not around to help him function in society, Rick communicates with his imaginary friend Alex.
Oh my God.
And he would talk to him. During promos, during matches.
I was wondering what the hell this was. This was a drawn-on mouth, drawn-on eyes that...
Fans would draw, like, faces on their hands and show them to the camera represent Alex.
Yeah, you clench your fist and then you move your thumb up and down to speak. And this was Rick Steiner's imaginary friend, Alex.
Well, I wish that the imaginary friend...
Well, listen, who would have thought a dude holding a sock and talking to a sock would get over like it has?
That's true. I mean? That's true.
This guy was actually a little ahead of his time, but this didn't really...
It was just such a departure when you're watching this show and then you have this goofy imaginary friend angle going on in the midst of... Like this, you know, they certainly had their kind of out there wacky storylines. They would get more into that as... The 90s would progress. Mm-hmm. But at this time, like, you're watching a show where it's really hits you. Like, this is very much closer to sport than it is what those guys are doing. We wrestle here.
Yeah.
And you had this goofball.
And even with this match, you know, Rotunda versus Steiner, where they started off with a lot of amateur wrestling, making it real, making it look real. And then you get into the dog kidnapping and all that stuff.
We will get there. Rotunda offers his hand to Rick Steiner after the early portion of the match where Rick's getting the better of Rotunda and Jim Ross is emphasizing their backgrounds, Rotunda out of Syracuse and Rick Steiner from the University of Michigan. And then Rick won't shake his hand, and they inform us Alex informed him they shouldn't be friends, Rick and Mike Rotunda. There's an abdominal stretch applied by Rotunda, and then he is grabbing the ropes for leverage here. Steiner then rolls over, lands on top for a two count. Rick goes to the top, misses with a splash. Rick is run into the steel post on the floor. And then Ross notes how Rick is just a simple man and brings up that he has a dog named Spike who's in the locker room as we speak. And just like that, Kevin Sullivan appears at ringside and mentions this dog is in the back, insinuating that he may harm the dog. And Rick goes to the floor and he's conflicted. Does he go save his dog or does he preserve his television championship, which he is defending here, against Mike Rotunda? These are conflicts.
Dog or TV title. Yeah, it's a. I think that was the storyline in the Super Bowl this year.
Yeah, so as Way has said in our review away promo, if it's a worthwhile angle, the dog probably wouldn't mind being harmed for a good angle. But, you know, between Al Snow and Big Boss Man and now Rick Steiner and Kevin Sullivan, I don't think any dogs have been part of any quality angles. We can add Chris Jericho and Stephanie McMahon to that.
That's a great question.
Much like cars and dogs, they just don't compute with wrestling angles.
Has there not been one good dog angle? What about like a...
Kennel from Hell?
Matilda never been in a good angle?
Matilda was stolen by the Islanders once. And then it built up to Bobby Heenan in a weasel suit where he was attacked by the dog.
Can't say, that doesn't sound like it was very good.
Yeah. Let us know, folks. Quality dog angles out there.
You know, let's open it up to pets.
Any pet angles.
Great pet angles.
You know, Earthquake sitting on Damien.
Yeah. That was kind of cool.
Animal death to get it across Earthquake as a heel. So Rick ultimately decides that, well, I can buy another dog, but I can't buy another championship. There's only one television title. So he returns to the ring. He takes a suplex, then avoids a dropkick, and he attacks Rotunda with punches in the corner, applies a sleeper, and somewhere in all of this, he has a cut above his right eye, and he goes to his back with like a rear naked choke applied, and JR describes Rotunda as going into sleepy by.
That's the other name for the movie.
Sounds way better. Sleepy by.
I'd love to see that called in the UFC.
So as Rick is choking this man unconscious, the referee counts three with Rick's shoulders on the mat applying this choke, and this results in a title change for the man who is getting choked out. Our first of many goofy finishes we would get on this show.
Yeah, definitely. This match seemed to have a bit of a...
16 and a half minutes, by the way.
A little too much going on, I'd say. I mean, between Alex, between, you know...
the dog.
The realistic tone set forth by the amateur wrestling, which I actually quite liked between the two, to the dog thing and nothing really coming of the dog. Like, it's... There are a lot of directions that I felt like the match was going towards. But in the end, they chose the one that made Rick Steiner look like the biggest idiot. And that's to have himself get pinned while applying a sleeper hold.
Didn't exactly build up the sympathy for the dog-faced gremlin who loses his title.
He could have lost his dog, too.
Man. Really, he doubled down and lost. Caudle is with the Road Warriors, who describe it as the OK Corral at high noon, but unlike Wyatt Earp, they don't use bullets because dead men can't feel pain. As Animal yells, this, if you weren't convinced, Michael Hayes was an 80s promo. Road Warrior Animal made up for it. Just right. A screaming animal. That's the best description.
What drug was it? What era would this be?
Oh, boy. The Road Warriors? Any and all. Barry Windham is with Hiro Matsuda. He says he's going to give Lex Luger the beating of his life and calls Lex his ex-pal. And that was our next match, a United States Championship, Barry Windham defending against Lex Luger. Ross asks if it's going to be Sting or Lex Luger who will control the 90s.
Great question.
The answer would be neither. And should have had Masala on this show, maybe.
Okay, who would you say would in WCW at least, control the 90s?
Who was their biggest star? Who was their face? I would say it was Flair in the 90s. Same answer as the 80s.
I don't know about that. Flair like had really big intermissions where he wasn't even around. You know, I'd say if anybody, it'd be like either maybe Hogan.
Hogan, Flair, Goldberg. I would put all of them ahead of Sting in terms of importance in the 90s.
Mm.
Myself.
Sting was always a constant, though.
He was there.
Yeah.
I would just say who is...
like when you think of like WCW...
If you want to talk about the guy who was there January the 1st of 1990 and December 31st, 1999 and all in between, yes, it would have been Sting.
Mm.
Luger introduces the sleeper hold. This coming after Magnum tells us that Luger has been watching his tapes on a VCR to study for this match.
Wow.
I cannot fathom this man sitting in front of a TV watching wrestling.
Why not?
Lex Luger?
Yeah. Why not?
I just think he had much better things to be doing with his time.
Listening to DMX, maybe.
They cut to Eddie Einhorn in the crowd, the owner of the Chicago White Sox, who briefly tried to start another national wrestling promotion that didn't really fare too well. Luger blocks an atomic drop, hits a lariat for a big pop. This was truly, I believe, Luger's peak as a babyface performer. The 1988, 1989, I mean, he was extremely over at this time. Luger misses a diving shoulder block off the top and tumbles to the floor. Windham hits a vertical suplex, bringing Luger back into the ring from the apron. And Luger's right eye is busted open from a shot. And then Windham misses with a right hand, hitting the steel post, and apparently really messed up his wrist. Like, this thing looked like a mess later in the back. And he was selling it so well that it felt like this has to have been a legit injury to his hand. But he did keep using it throughout the match. So it was hard to tell, other than they did do this close-up, and it was, like, cut up, and he did something to it.
I mean, it was so... I thought they played it up so much that I really just assumed that it was just part of the match.
Yeah, I don't know.
I've also never seen... I've seen wrist injuries. I've never necessarily seen blade jobs on wrists. You know what I mean?
They were a different breed in 89 way.
Like, a bloody wrist to signify. I thought it worked up well. You know, I thought Windham did a great job selling the limitations the injury had on his offense.
Yeah, so I didn't even mind. Windham was using the hand, but every time he would use it, he would sell big. Like, this is his big weapon, and it's going to take a toll out of him to use this big weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So told a good story in that regard.
Yeah,
he hit him with a superplex. Luger kicked out, and then Windham hit a bridging back suplex. And both their shoulders are down, and Luger pops his shoulder up before the three count, and Luger is declared the winner. Our second stupid finish of the night, as Luger wins the U.S. title off this, getting this shoulder up. It was like, I don't know, to do these back-to-back was just unnecessary,
mm-hmm.
I felt.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, Windham attacked Luger with a pile driver onto the championship, and Luger is your new U.S. champion. Big reaction for the title switch.
It was a big reaction, yeah. But it also seemed like the way it was booked, it wasn't something that was necessarily earned, you know?
He won it on a technicality, much like... And a babyface winning it, too, in this regard. It was it just seemed awkward. Caudle is with Mike Rotunda. He says, no one cares how it's done. It just matters that he won the title, and that's how people will view this. Says the title was originally stolen for him by Rick Steiner anyway, and now he has got his property back. Tag team title match was next. Road Warriors taking on Dr. Death, Steve Williams, and Kevin Sullivan. And Animal and a Hawk were as over as anybody on this show. In Chicago, no less. No surprise. Animal no-sells a Kevin Sullivan clothesline and then knocks him down as the crowd just roars in approval. Catches Sullivan, hits a power slam off the top. Hawk is in with a military press and an elbow drop to Dr. Death. Then they hit a double clothesline to Dr. Death, and he kicks out. And Ross puts over what a major feat it was that Dr. Death kicked out of that double clothesline. And Sullivan then attacks Animal with a chair to the left arm on the floor for the heat. The Varsity Club beats down on Animal, attacks the arm. They're making frequent tags in and out to isolate Animal. And then Williams climbs to the top, nearly slips as he comes off, and then it's a double clothesline. Both men are down. Hawk gets the hot tag for a big reaction, comes in. He's making a comeback on Sullivan. Hawk and Dr. Death then fight on the floor. Animal hoists up Kevin Sullivan onto his shoulders, but is attacked by Dr. Death from behind to his lower back. So Hawk then climbs to the top, clotheslines Kevin Sullivan, and then Hawk pins Sullivan as Doc has Animal pinned. So we had the double pin, but they explained Kevin Sullivan was the legal man, and therefore the Road Warriors cover counts, and they get the win and keep the tag titles at 8:26.
It was
third finish.
A third finish in a row that was a little confusing and also made the person who lost look really dumb. And also made the person who won, I mean, it didn't look all that impressive of a win, none of these.
It just felt like strange. This continual theme of let's protect the guy that's losing the match.
Yeah, but instead they just made him look really stupid. Dr. Death here just didn't realize who was legal and just like kept waiting. I don't know. It just looked dumb.
Caudle interviews Lex Luger. His head is all wrapped up, says his neck is hurt. Says Wyndham may have broken his wrist. He thanks the fans and put over how tough that match was with Barry Wyndham. Then they showed a video of Flair and Steamboat, including Steamboat pinning Flair on television after a high cross off the top to set up that as a potential finish to the match. There's an interview segment from the Clash of Champions 5 where the suit is torn off of Ric Flair and got the visual fall on Ric Flair, and Hiro Matsuda holding Ricky Steamboat as Flair attacked him. So we found one purpose for Hiro Matsuda in the build-up to this. And Flair chopping Ricky Steamboat so his chest was all red in the lead-up to this. All done to some beautiful music. Mm-hmm. Quite the montage. So that sets up our main event for the NWA title, Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat, with Ric Flair defending. Ross just excellent here, setting up the tempo, the history of the title, doing some creative history going back to 1905 and saying there had been two NWA title changes in the history of Chicago and that they have the top referee in the business, Tommy Young, as the third man in the ring. They also showed Brad Muster, a high draft pick of the Chicago Bears, in the crowd sitting next to Dave Meltzer.
Wow.
And Ross notes how the mayoral candidates in Chicago should be here because of all these voters in the arena. They should be doing some canvassing tonight at the NWA Chi-Town Rumble.
Maybe a young Barack Obama would have been here.
Perhaps. I'm sure he was a big Flair Steamboat follower. As I mentioned before, Ross outlined Flair from the private school sector, and Steamboat is a product of the public school system.
Ooh.
The common man. It says how Flair travels in fast circles. Steamboat is a product of the family unit. And just some incredible chops from these two. Unreal. Ross's calling of the near falls were just amazing. There was a chop off the ropes, and Flair just falls to the floor, selling huge. And they cut to the NWA title during this sequence, much like they do in New Japan for the title matches, just a cut to the shot of the title. And Magnum TA estimates that the value of that title is about $40,000, depending on the diamond market value as of today.
Oh, I love it.
Hasn't got his newspaper today to check the stocks, but if the diamond market is where I believe it is, that's a $40,000 piece of gold.
I will buy that, especially as a child. I will buy that figure. I don't know anything about that stuff, so it sounds about right. 40,000.
Ricky Steamboat hit a flying head scissors. Ross puts over reporters that have flocked to Chicago, including George Napolitano and Dennis Brent, Japanese reporters, but no love for
what?
Dave Meltzer.
Oh.
There he is.
Well, he was attending as a fan, not as a reporter.
Oh, he was reporting on this.
No, he wasn't taking notes. He was there, like, he was marking out for this match.
Flair got the advantage as they returned to the ring. Steamboat reversed a top rope crossbody for this unreal near fall. This was great. Playing off of the television finish. Flair then applies the figure four. He's using the rope for leverage, and Steamboat furiously tapping in 1989, to this figure four.
Yeah,
and then Jim Ross notes, there is Hiro Matsuda, the evil man from the Orient.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different time.
No offense was meant. And, like, the Orient, I think, you know, I'm not even one to speak. I'm in no way a spokesperson, but it's not a word I really get all that worked up about, you know. There are worse words, I think. Especially at this time, I think it really just the way that people use to describe it.
There was no malice intended. It was 1989. It was a crazy time.
Yeah. And, I mean, they're talking about characters here. If anything, even though, you know, the man is Hawaiian, you can really look at, you know, their faith in somebody who looks like Ricky Steamboat as you know, a real kind of a great thing that they do for people that look like myself.
Flair attacks the left knee of Steamboat, and then Flair dives at Steamboat, and they fly over the top to the floor. Steamboat is run into the post. They go back into the ring. Flair just getting a bunch of two counts. Crowd is at the edge of their seat pretty much from when this match starts to when it ends, and Steamboat keeps kicking out. There's this desperation schoolboy by Steamboat for a two count, this hope spot. Then he bridges underneath of Flair into a double underhook suplex, but Flair gets his foot on the bottom rope to break the fall. Steamboat climbs to the top, hits this judo chop, as it's described off the top. Then he hits the top rope crossbody, but in the process, they knock out Tommy Young. And Steamboat has Flair pinned. The referee is out. Then Flair gets out, rolls up Steamboat, and is hooking the tights illegally, but Tommy Young is still out. Steamboat then misses a crossbody off the top. Flair goes for the figure four, and then referee Teddy Long runs into the ring as Steamboat counters the figure four with an inside cradle counter and pins Flair at 23 minutes and 18 seconds, and the crowd explodes for the title change, and Ricky Steamboat wins the title. Mm-hmm. Unbelievable match.
Yeah, I mean, a real just back-and-forth war where both men were very aggressive and also very technical. Again, the crowd, just another big aspect of this match. JR was great here. It was just really good professional wrestling.
A fantastic match. How did this hold up going in where you know this match is held in such high regard?
Yeah, to be honest, it kind of... it was a little.
Were the expectations so high?
Maybe, yeah. And I know that, you know, this is not really the only match that obviously these two have had.
Throughout the year we're going to try and review all the Flair Steamboat matches of '89. There were three big ones.
Yeah, but I personally, it was a little underwhelming, just because maybe my expectations were too high, and also maybe it was just, you know, the style. You know, just being somebody who's so used to these days. I mean, I just watched Tanahashi Okada from last week, and that's certainly not.
You're spoiled. That's what you are.
It's certainly not the same style and not the same context that I should be watching this with. But it's just kind of hard to even personally to separate the two.
And then afterwards, this was awesome. Bob Caudle interviews Ricky Steamboat in the back with the title. All the other baby faces are in there with champagne, including Lex Luger, who decided to wear a towel for this segment. And Ricky Steamboat takes the bottle of champagne, he chugs it, and pours it over his head, and clearly got it in his eyes. And he could not open his eyes for the life of him, to the point someone has to give him a towel, hopefully not the one Luger was wearing, and rub his eyes that are just full of champagne as he's trying to cut his post-match victory promo, and just puts over the NWA and saying they need to get it back to number one where it belongs. And Caudle just says, well, if anyone can do it, Rick Steamboat can. And he puts over Flair as a great champion and will give him a rematch when he wants one as well, which they would do just about 6 weeks later on the Clash of the Champions show, which would go head-to-head on the same day as WrestleMania 5 in New Orleans. And Ross and Magnum wrap up the show, three title changes on this show. So that was a very big deal for one show to have that many title switches in one night. And changing course in a lot of different directions. So I thought a pretty good show. It was clearly the main event is what sticks out in history on this show. I really loved going back and watching this main event. I quite enjoyed it, and I gave this show I give it a 7 out of 10. I didn't think it was the greatest show of all time, but I thought the main event was tremendous.
Yeah, I give it about 7 as well.
All right. Well, that was the Chi-Town Rumble. We're going to go to the feedback thread, and we'll start off with Christian Small. A fun little show from the NWA. Didn't think this show picked up until the Midnight Express match. Jim Cornette's fantastic book, The Midnight Express 25th Anniversary, added some interesting details to this match. Apparently on the day, Dennis Condrey just no-showed, as nothing was mentioned of a Loser Leaves Town match or getting him a new partner when Randy Rose would lose, so they got Jack Victory, who was Russian Assassin number 2, to do double duty. The book also adds that while many hold the Midnight Express as a legendary tag team, they were always fighting for programs to do within every company they went. If you haven't read it, I recommend it. Other notes, the NWA logo looked more like it said AWA. I couldn't help but notice that Bob Caudle had to hold Road Warrior Animal back during their promo as he thought Paul Ellering had finished before he did. I don't understand why Hiro Matsuda was a manager. He didn't say a single word or show one emotion throughout the entire show. The final thing for me is the main event. It was the first in a great trilogy of matches, and I think it still holds up today. Personally feel they got better as they went on, and I love the idea of you guys coming back to review this trilogy show. I really hope that you do the rest. Thanks for the hard work. I might be wrong. That might have been Jack Victory in that opening match. Russian Assassin number one was David Sheldon, but if I'm mistaken.
Wasn't Victory in the next match?
Well, he was saying that he worked double duty. He would have worked the opening match and then the six-man later on. So that might have been the case.
We go to Chris from Winnipeg who says, "Hi, John and Way. Having never seen a Flair Steamboat Classic, I decided to watch this week's show. Sometimes it's tough to get through some of the longer matches with guys like Mike Rotunda and Lex Luger, but it's also nice to see unexpected gems like a young Paul E. Dangerously and a prime Road Warriors. The main event did deliver and propped up an otherwise average card. Two other random observations. One, Magnum T.A.'s mullet deserves some Scott Putski Award consideration. Two, for a show in Chicago, there were shockingly few CM Punk chants. Huh? We didn't give a Scott Putski Award.
Feels so routine on these Luger shows. Was there anyone else that really jumped out at you? I mean, there were Hawk and Animal.
Butch Reed.
Yeah, Butch Reed, too.
Yeah, a lot of guys, really. I mean,
it was the 80s.
I mean, Dave Meltzer looked a little jacked. He was a bodybuilder, was he not?
Butch Reed was a pretty inflated body.
All right.
I'm going to let you name it.
I will take Chris from Winnipeg's suggestion and award the Scott Putski Award.
To Magnum's mullet?
To Magnum T.A.'s mullet.
Okay. Magnum T.A. There were some hideous mullets on this particular
this
show. I mean, this was the peak.
This was like a lookbook from a 1980s hairdresser.
My goodness. Bill from Hamilton. You wouldn't think the NWA had many internal problems at the time due to the product being quite solid still at this time, as the sale to Turner had taken place not long before this, and the Crockett's were losing more and more power as time progressed and Jim Herd was brought in soon after. Despite this, on the surface, the cracks in the foundation weren't overly visible. You could see the company was trying hard to keep Sting heavily relevant on the show, showcasing him in a long competitive match with a solid worker like Butch Reed. I always thought the Rotunda-Steiner rivalry was underrated when it came to discussing the better feuds of 80s NWA. The issue between the two was merely built on hatred and pride. And dogs. And Rick fought like a valiant warrior regardless of victory or defeat. It was a fantastic babyface heel scenario. Wyndham and Luger's feud was always red hot and entertaining. And Flair Steamboat, does anything need to be said? There's a reason why when people see a subpar match, they tend to say, well, it wasn't exactly Flair versus Steamboat. All in all, a good show during an era of uncertainty for the company. Yeah, certainly a transitional period at this point.
Brad from Whippy. For me, the show boils down to just two matches. The obvious is the amazing main event, which is simply just a great match. I had never seen any of the matches from the set that Flair and Steamboat had, but after seeing this one, I'd be more interested in setting the remainder. Here's the shocker, though. I like the Luger match. Maybe it was those phenomenal new moves he debuted, but this match was entertaining. If I may, guys, I would like to now give you some general review-away feedback. I'm currently going through the archives and I've noticed some things that have stopped, and I would like to see return. The first is contests. Now, I know you do the Christmas song and think you did a Halloween contest last year, but in the early days, you guys used to do a lot more. I enjoyed all the submissions and the wonderful prizes like Way's bootleg Polish DVD of Santa with Muscles. Second is guest hosts. I love Damien, but let's get some variety. Arda was amazing when he was on. What about Moro, Court, Alex Greenfield, Trish Stratus, or Jeff Merrick? P.S. John, still have some broken links in the archives.
Okay, well, you know what, Brad? Some patience, all right? That's, I'm going to get around to it.
Get on that right now.
The thing with the guest hosts, it's like, A, we want the right mix of people, and we've had, you know, we've had Court come on, we've had Alex come on. Sometimes as well, it's, yeah, I'm not a big fan of doing them on, like, these kinds of reviews, especially on the phone or on Skype.
Yeah.
I just find it's a lengthier conversation that I like to do in person.
I also don't worry about bothering people. You know, and
it's a lot to ask of people for any of these to watch a 3-hour pay-per-view and then join us for 2 hours to talk about it. It's not always the easiest.
Yeah, it's. I think it's one thing to, you know, ask for 15 minutes of like somebody's time to do an interview, but to have them come all the way in here and do like an hour and a half review, also take a maybe like 2 hours or 3 hours out of their week to watch.
I still feel bad about asking Way to do it. He just hasn't turned me down yet in 5 years. But if it's the right person, we'll certainly do them.
And the contest, absolutely. I think we need more contests. And we have some ideas brewing, but definitely we'll be adding more contests.
Kevin from Danville. This was a fantastic show back in the day. 25 years later, it seems that some of the matches did not age well. He says Luger Rotunda. I imagine he means Rick Steiner and Rotunda. But Flair Steamboat works all day, every day. Even some of their work in the early 80s and late 70s would still play well today. Overall, this show was a 9.5 back then. Now it's a 7. Yet it is still better than 80% of what WWE and TNA produces today, NXT not included. Thanks for your hard work.
Finally, Ronaldo from Milan, who says, when I was a kid, I only knew Steamboat for being a fire-breathing dragon of sorts. Years later, I discovered this jewel of a series of matches and was in awe at how much over and talented the guy actually was and the gold he would produce with Flair even way before this famous series. A sad reminder of what a true alternative to WWE could be and actually was. Top notch, and God bless Triple H of anyone for actually having developmental guys in OVW study matches like these a few years ago.
All right, we're going to wrap things up. Thanks for your feedback to the Chi-Town Rumble of 1989. Next week, we are going to fast forward 12 years from the Chi-Town Rumble to 2001. A golden period in the WWE, and it was the final pay-per-view before arguably their best WrestleMania of all time, WrestleMania X7. We are going to stop in Las Vegas, Nevada for No Way Out 2001, featuring Kurt Angle and The Rock, featuring Triple H and Austin in a three stages of hell match, and lots more at this peak time in the WWF. So a February-themed pay-per-view. No Way Out.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the final pay-per-view before WCW went under.
They would go out of business about a month afterwards. So an interesting time, to say the least, in the history of North American wrestling. So that'll be next week's review. No Way Out 2001. We'll see how well that ages.
I think it'll age pretty well. Yeah, well, I mean, I remember that match, the three stages of hell match, being a classic.
One of the longest matches in WWF pay-per-view history. Not the longest, but it was a sizable length. So we'll chat about that next week. As we've mentioned, at some point in the future, we'll definitely go back to some more of this 1989. I could watch this NWA stuff because a lot of these big shows, I mean, as I said, I was not watching the NWA at the age of 4, so I've watched select stuff at this time, but I like going back to these eras where I wasn't, you know, a fan at the time and watching some of this stuff, and they have so much now. Clash of the Champions and all their pay-per-views up there. So we will get back to these at some point down the road, and we got to get to the conclusion of Rick Steiner and his dog, Spike.
I need to know.
What happened with Spike Steiner?
More so, what about Alex?
So many questions. All right, so we are going to get on out of here. I want to thank everyone for stopping by. You can, of course, go to liveaudiowrestling.com, subscribe to all our stuff on iTunes. I've heard from many people about Stitcher has had some issues updating. It's a system-wide issue with Stitcher, so it's really out of our control. It's not just our show. It's tons of shows with Stitcher that they're having issues with. So if you do listen on Stitcher, hopefully they're going to be correcting their problems that they're having, but you can always listen on the Fight Network app, which is a free app. There's a podcast section where all of our shows go up to. If you don't listen to them on iTunes or download them, many different options to listen to the shows. And, of course, we are going to be down in San Jose for WrestleMania weekend with our live podcast on Sunday, March 29th, WrestleMania Day. We are going to be at the Smoking Pig Barbecue in San Jose, 11:30 a.m. Pacific time. We'll be recording a live podcast. We're going to be doing a live Q&A with the people that are there already have a ton of people signed up that are going to be coming. So you can get all the information at lawradio.proboards.com. It is stickied at the top there, so you can get all your info there. Wei Ting is bracing himself for a day of barbecue and wrestling.
Yes, and that's it. Nothing else.
Yes. All right, we will get on out of here. Best thing to go out with to put a cap on Chi-Town Rumble, I think some more of Jim Ross to end the show. So we will chat with you next week to chat No Way Out 2001, also featuring Jim Ross.
Another chop by the Dragon. The number one contender is fighting this one for his family, for his young son, for every working class person in America. He's giving it his all. Oh, there's a clothesline. The Dragon came out of nowhere with a clothesline. He's going to go for it all right here. He's going for it all. The Dragon with a Dino chop. Ric Flair is in trouble. The Dragon reaching down. You got to think he's got that young son, the little Dragon, right in front of his mind. He's on top. The Dragon will fly. He nailed it. Oh, Tommy Young went down. He's got Flair pinned. Tommy Young, the referee, down. Teddy Long coming in. Steamboat over the top. What's he going? Wait, Steamboat's coming back up top. This match is still going on. And Steamboat flies, but he missed it. He missed the flying body press off the top. And now Flair has turned the corner. He twists the leg. Inside. Wait a minute, inside cradle. Can he hold him? Yes, he can. Ricky the Dragon Steamboat has won the world title.
It was the ultimate counter. Who would have figured that at Full Roll? Small package, no life. The champion goes down.
Ladies and gentlemen, in 23 minutes and 18 seconds, the winner and new World Heavyweight Champion, Ricky the Dragon!